Season 2 of Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Today, we are delighted to have as a guest somebody who knows a lot about not just food, but how to grow it and how to grow it wisely and how to make plants and landscapes healthy again. And my guest is Kelly Westgate. Kelly Westgate lives in Vernon. She's the owner and operator of Lecker Land Design, which is involved in things like setting up a landscape and making it work in every possible way. And she also has a strong interest and background in composting. Composting is the way you turn what we sometimes have thrown out in the past into new soil and rich soil at the same time. Kelly, welcome this morning.
Thank you so much, Warren. It's great to be here.
Well, it's lovely to have you. And I think we should start the show off not with what we're going to do immediately, which is talk about your trajectory towards the work you're doing now in Salmon Arm with the food forest, but talk a little bit about what's happening right now, because we're in the midst of a very challenging time. Listeners are undoubtedly aware of the fact that food distribution systems have been sharply disrupted by meteorological events that are the kind that scientists have been predicting would come upon us for probably 30 years, and now they're starting to happen. We're in the midst of a rain river.
A river in the sky.
It's a river in the sky. And that is a powerful event that has washed out roads, has flooded farms, has unfortunately drowned some food-producing operations and the animals living on them. Kelly, as you observe this from many years of being involved with food and the sort of ecosystem in which food is grown, do you have some reflections on what's going on right now?
Yeah, you know, I would say that my interest in food and food security and water security started in disaster times. It didn't seem like a huge deal when it first happened, but living in Vancouver when I was pregnant with my son, there was a landslide into the aquifer on the coast. And the effects of that, you know, we saw very quickly that people started doing what they're doing now. They start hoarding immediately. So the things that were flying off the shelves right away was bottled water, and your basics, like we're seeing now, your milk, your eggs, you know, immediately people have this instinct that, I don't know how long this is going to last. I need to protect my family. And it really sunk in deeply with me just how quickly that mindset changes.
It's a return to a foraging mindset. Our ancient
sort of straight into survival mode.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's a time of transformation that is finally becoming real for a lot of people who allowed themselves to kind of complacently convince themselves that it was just talk. It was a bunch of people who, yes, they're on the news and they have some things to say, but it's not really relevant to us. So I think it's appropriate for us to now start talking about how you got into the world of food. But before we do that, I want to point out that your business is called Lecker Land Design. So, being a bit of a studious chap, I looked up the word lekker, and it's a Dutch term, which has a bunch of meanings, and we'll be talking about the fact that you ended up in Holland for a while at some point. But the meaning is, originally it was tasty, yummy, and it was referred to food, but it's now become, in Dutch, a term for everything that's pretty just good. You know, if you're having a lekker time, you're having a terrific time. Was that a deliberate choice? Was this the typical play on words, using even a play on words from another language?
Yeah, I think, I wanted something sort of short and punchy, and the word lekker, when the Dutch people say the word lekker, they generally tend to wave their hand beside their ear for some reason. I don't know why, but having lived there, it did stick with me, and that's really, the essence of what I have been planning to do with this business is create delicious landscapes, landscapes where we can sort of wander through the garden and graze on what's available at the time. And, being the mother to a son, as any parent knows with a young boy, they eat and they eat and they eat. So, if he's hungry, I can say, well, not at this time of year, but I can say, go out to the garden and see what's fresh. And that was really important to me to create. But yeah, lekker, I mean, for anybody who is Dutch or even, Afrikaans or German, they'll understand this word as, it's delicious. And so it just gives you a sense of like, something good is going to happen here.
The land is delicious once again.
Yes.
Well, I think that's a way to start into a process that has led you not from the traditional sort of farming background, the traditional, we had a big garden and we grew lots of food, and that's why I got interested in food. In fact, when you were born in Vernon, then you moved to Fort St. John and you end up in Nelson, and that's only the beginning. When your parents bought a lovely house, I believe in Nelson, there was a garden in it, and what did they do to the garden?
Well, that was actually in Grand
Oh,
Forks.
well,
There
there
was a
you are.
beautiful,
See,
that
I
was a
can't even
beautiful,
keep up with you
I know,
anymore.
there was a lot of moving. We were very migratory. Yeah, there was a big vegetable garden when we first moved into this house, and they ripped it up and put in a lawn. So
Well,
yeah, not definitely wasn't part of my upbringing, I would say.
absolutely. Although you did find one feature of your garden, and that was a large tree next to the house. Talk about your visitations up the tree. What role did that tree play in your life?
Oh, when we first moved to Nelson, we had a big ponderosa pine right off of our deck. And being that we had moved and I didn't have a lot of friends, I was always a very avid reader. And this tree just called to me. So I would climb that tree with my books and spend a couple hours. I'd take a snack and just go read in the tree.
Did your parents ever miss you up the tree, or did they always know you were there?
Oh yeah, they could see me from the kitchen, so they knew I was there.
They knew they had an unusual child. Now, your mother also is a reader.
Yes.
And there is an interesting story you told me about Iceland. When you finally sort of dug into your sort of cultural roots, they weren't a big deal in your own family, your own personal family, but your mom's background is Icelandic, and there's an unusual custom at Christmas in Iceland. Tell our listeners about
This
that.
is something that I've just learned in the last couple years. But we didn't really have a sense of connection to culture so much. And since doing this ancestry research, I did learn that in Iceland at Christmas, the tradition is that you give a book to somebody and maybe a box of chocolates, and you spend the rest of Christmas Day reading,
Eating
just quiet.
chocolates and reading.
Just being cozy by the fire and reading books. Yeah. So maybe that's where I got my love of books.
And being Iceland, it's probably a geothermal heating system. Apparently, almost all
It
of
is.
Reykjavik is heated, 80%, 90% is heated by geothermal and hydropower. Yes. Well, it may not be an active cultural element in your life, but it's certainly the behavior has become certainly part of what you do. And as you're listening to this show, you'll realize that Kelly is a reader and has a very inquisitive mind and has learned a lot of things around the world, and brought them into the work she's doing today. So, not even though food and sort of the plant life outside was not a major interest in your family, early on in your life, you developed a fondness for willow trees. Where did that come from? Where did that, I mean, obviously, sometimes when things happen early in life, you don't know exactly where they come from, but Where do you think that came from?
I guess I don't have a lot of memories of Vernon from living here in my early childhood, but, you know, I must have had an imprint of seeing the willow trees here at Polson Park when I was a child. I know that there were some photos of, you know, feeding the ducks at the park, and maybe even I always sort of connected them to the Dr. Seuss books. The Trifula Trees. I'm trying to remember the name of the book, but some people would remember it's they cut down all the trees, and, you know, it's just something about the way that they wave in the wind, and they're just so beautiful. And, you know, since becoming a permaculture designer and learning more about different values of different trees, learning that you can weave the whips into either a raised garden bed or a basket or anything like that, and you can chop up the branches and use them as a rooting hormone for transplanting. It's a fascinating tree, and it's very beautiful. It's very, you know, not the most water wise tree, I would say, but very iconic. Yeah.
And as Suzanne Simard has pointed out to us in her work on deciduous trees feeding conifers, through fungal growth underneath the soil, it's quite clear that willow trees, which have maybe become famous because of their bark and their sometimes the connection to salicylic acid, they're actually playing a very important role, and we humans should pay more attention to them and not sort of relegate them to, you know, the sideline in the plant kingdom. Now, your dad's background was sort of Irish English, and he'd been in Canada for a couple of hundred years. So that was he was by the time you came on the scene, he was very much a Canadian. He might have had some Irish connections, but he was American. So you were not given this sort of strong cultural heritage. You didn't have this world around you where food and planting and plants and the natural ecosystem. But what you did do is you went for walks. It was a family process at times of going for walks in the woods and in around and about in places where there were plants and trees and stuff like that. That's played a part in your life as well.
Yeah, you know, we always had dogs, so we always had to go out for walks. They always needed to be walked, so that was a great excuse to get out. And living in small towns, rurally, you know, in the analog days, pre-internet, that was what there was to do. So we would just wander, and we would use our imaginations, and we would have deep conversations, and there weren't as many distractions. We could really observe as we were walking, and we'd run into herds of deer, or, you know, the word on the street would be that, you know, a neighbor had a bear in the tree, or I just always felt an affinity for all the creatures and just the biodiversity and even the forest floor. And yeah, it was just always really fascinating to me, the amount of different things going on in those ecosystems.
Now, these ecosystems were available to you, the natural ecosystems, but the social ecosystem was a little fragmented for you because your father was a banker, and every couple of years, you guys took a hike, not a hike in the woods, but a hike away from where you'd been living. That had an influence on you as well. So because your father was a banker, you guys moved a lot, and that changed the social patterns in your life. And also exposed you to lots of different parts of this province. So expand on that a little bit, Kelly. How did that shape you?
Well, you know, I think when you move around a lot, you have to very quickly learn that it's up to you to reach out to people if you want friends and connections. It's, you know, particularly in small communities, they tend to be very tight-knit. And so when a new person comes in, it's interesting. And who is this person? But sometimes there's a mistrust. And so you have to learn the skills to build trust and to you know, we survive on community. We need community. So, opening up conversations and getting to know people, I found that that's always been an interest of mine because of that growing up, is like, well, who are you and where, what's your story? And then moving to these different areas, you know, gave me a deep love of this province, first of all, and seeing all the different topographies and, you know, being in Grand Forks, for example, opened me up to the Russian culture and Dukhobors and their foods. So, you know, eating borscht and Nalezhniki and Petahi and all these different foods that I would never would have known. And then also just being more migratory, which, you know, in my personal opinion is maybe more of a natural way to be, and more of the way, you know, Indigenous people would have lived pre-contact, is that you go where the opportunity is, or you follow, you know, you follow the food, or you follow the jobs, you know, and the jobs mean the money, which means the food. And so, it gave me a sense of being a human in the world versus, you know, a resident of a town.
Did it also give you a sense of intellectual diversity in your own mind? Because you were actually, therefore, in terms of your own intellectual development, you were looking inward. You were looking for the various sources of information you could gather, because it wasn't tied to sort of community events and being involved with all sorts of community networks and that kind of thing. So did you find that along the way, because you are a very well-informed person, did you find that it sort of led you to use the reading and the exploring of ideas as sort of a theme that kind of ran through what you did when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think each town that we lived in created a learning opportunity. You know, it was like, okay, well, where are we now? You know, let's look at the map.
This is Tuesday. Where are we?
Here, and this is the distance from here to there. And so if I made friends in one town, you know, how was I going to get back to see those friends in a different town? And then, you know, I lived in Castlegar for a while, and I had a Portuguese friend there. So I learned a little bit about Portuguese culture and ultimately married a Portuguese man. So, yeah, I mean, it also gave me that curiosity about people, because I wanted to learn about people. So that meant that I needed to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And I think when you live in one town for your whole life, that curiosity may not be there as strongly, because, well, I know you know, you're the guy that did the thing in grade two. Sure. Whereas for me, I'm going, well, tell me about the first 15 years of your life. You know,
what did you do in grade two?
Yeah. So there was a, you know, I wanted to learn about people and their stories. And and my friend in Castlegar, her father was a baker. And so I got to see him make big batches of sweet bread. And I tried sweet bread. I was like, what is this? This is amazing. And he was just he was so good at it. But it you know, it just sparked something like, wow, my family ate, you know, very bland, very, you know, sort of white, you know, meat, potatoes and vegetables. And a lot of it was microwaved or, you know, it was very, very basic, not a lot of flavor. Peppers or, you know, things with spice or anything like that. So
I know what you're talking about. I grew up in an English family. If the peas weren't gray after they'd been cooked, they weren't done properly. They weren't done properly. Yeah. And the sense that I've got in talking to you is that intellectual curiosity is central to how you approach many things in your life. That's been sort of a theme. Oh, here's a new idea. Let's explore it. That kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm very curious and very interested. I'm a lifelong learner. You know, I believe that we're always learning. And so I really seek to understand. And maybe the fact that I didn't grow up in a, you know, distinct culture per se led me to seek those things, you know, well, who am I and where is my place in the world and what is my culture and why don't I have, you know, grandma's recipe for whatever. And so that led me to want to know, and wanting to know led to this discovery that's been really fascinating. But yeah, I would say it took probably half of my life before I started to be interested in that.
So maybe now you'll just have 15 grandmothers with recipes instead of just one.
Now I want all the recipes, yeah.
Now, there's one experience you told me about when you were very young. You were about 4, and you had an opportunity to feed a very large animal. A very large animal being, in this case, a horse. That was a very sweet story. Tell me about what happened then. Because that really, you remember it. It sticks in your mind.
I do. And, you know, I wonder sometimes if those memories are actual memories or because there's photographic evidence. And we didn't take a lot of photos, you know, back then. It was a little more expensive and a process to do. But
Brownie Star Flash.
We were camping at Whispering Pines, and we could feed apples to the horses. And, you know, I remember being so small and the horse being so big, and just, you know, at that height that I was at, the apple going into the horse's mouth was just right there in full Technicolor. So, yeah, we didn't have a lot of, like I said, farm experience or anything like that. But even that connection with an animal that is so beautiful and powerful and yet gentle and, yeah.
Well, and we talked about this as well, about the sense of awe that sometimes you, and I think many, many people have experienced when they're in the presence of another species. It could be a plant, but plants don't move around as much. But animals which do, they have kind of an energy and a consciousness that is different from ours, and therefore often very fascinating. Many people have described this. Would that be a fair thing to say has been part of your experience as well?
Oh, definitely. I, you know, even the deer that used to, you know, eat mom's tulips in the front yard, you know, she'd be mad at them. And I would just be staring out the window going, wow, look at the muscles and look at the, you know, just that big there, they're right there. You know, we just had a front row seat. So, I do have a love of animals. And I think, you know, that has extended into even, strangely, a love of insects and a love of, you know, what's going on under the soil and how many creatures there are there in the rhizosphere and you know, now getting into composting and whatnot, learning about worms and what's going on with worms and what are they doing under there, yeah. And, you know, how do they do that? So, yeah, it's that wanting to understand and connect and, you know, maybe depending on your spiritual beliefs, you know, we were all put here for a reason. And I've always kind of been seeking, like, what is that purpose? What is that reason that I'm here? And in that, yeah, I do see the soul of the animal and the soul of the creature, and just am in awe of the wisdom and systems of the natural world. And it's fascinating to me.
Early on in your formal learning experience, you met a teacher who, when you were in grade 4, really inspired you, really motivated you. Why don't you talk about this special person in your life?
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to give her praise. She lives in Salmon Arm now, and she taught me back up in Fort St. John.
So why don't we mention her name so that if she's listening to this show, you and she can get together.
I'm happy to. Yes, we have reconnected. I think we ran into each other at a seed swap. But Kathy Huska, an incredible teacher, and she lives in Salmon Arm. And I think I ran into her at the Apple Fest in Salmon Arm when I was running a booth there, and then I've run into her since, and it's just, you know, I'll never forget her. You know, she changed my life. She saw something in me at a young age, and she knew that I would, you know, I've always been a bit nerdy and a bit addicted to information, so she would give me extra work, and then ultimately you know, something that I don't think really happens anymore, she had said that I should be put ahead of grade. I was just a little bit bored and not enough challenge. And so in the 5th grade, she put me forward to the 6th grade at Christmas. And that really changed my life. You know, because of her and that decision, I ended up being an exchange student because I graduated from high school a year early. And, you know, you can say that my business is called Lecker Land Design because of this experience in the fourth and fifth grade with this excellent teacher. So teachers are so important. So thank you, Kathy Huska. You are amazing.
It's almost a rule that in everyone's life, there are people who come along who alter the course of your life. People who you're going in one direction, suddenly you're going in another because a whole new vista opens up. In this particular case with Kathy, it was a vista about yourself, a sort of an awareness of the fact that you were, I think you put it, you were seen. You were seen. There was somebody who saw you as you were and also encouraged you, gave you a sense of, you know, the capacity you had in you to excel at some things and to be, you know, a real contributor to the world around you. Now, in the exchange you mentioned just a moment ago was to go where? What was that particular exchange about?
So my father was a Rotarian. So throughout my sort of between the ages of about 13 to 17, we had a number of exchange students that would come and live with us from different countries. So we had Japanese girls, we had a Mexican girl and a Dutch girl. And so these would be my host. I was their host sister. So they would live with us for a couple of months. And during my last year of high school with my Dutch sister, I thought, you know, this is really cool. How can I do this? So I got in touch with the counselor at the high school and said, you know, what's this Rotary Exchange program? This sounds really up my alley. And they said, well, you know, we don't really do it. And it kind of, we used to do it, but we haven't done it. And I was like, well, we should do it. I'm going to go. So we had to make a list of all the countries that we thought we may want to go to out of the options that were given. And although the Netherlands was about fifth on my list, the Rotary Club in Holland, that I guess they had a say in where they got students from. So they selected me.
So how many countries did you have in your list? Here's somebody, a young person who reads a lot, who's seen now, who knows that she has intellectual gifts, who is sort of thinking, and who moves every 2 years anyway. So how many countries were on your list?
Well, I think we were allowed to put five, and I think my top four were actually Latin countries. So I had, you know, I had Colombia, I had Spain.
Did you have Portugal? Was it already there?
I don't remember the actual list. I know I remember Colombia being one of them because my mother said, absolutely not.
She nixed it.
Yeah. But, this was all, again, pre-internet. So we couldn't research things like we can now.
So Kelly, you had the Netherlands on your list, but it wasn't number one, but something happened. You went there.
I did. I spent a year in the Netherlands and lived with four different families throughout the year. So again, you know, more change, but very different families and situations, but, you know, bringing it back to food, you know, that experience led to even more experiences because, you know, I got to try things like lumpia, which, you know, you wouldn't expect to have in the Netherlands, but that's a Vietnamese spring roll because they had market days. And that was something that was new for me because we're, you know, in the Western world, we're very much the supermarket. Everything is from one place. And what I saw in the Netherlands was, okay, you want meat, you go to the butchers, you know, you want bread, you go to the baker. And then Wednesdays was market day. And I'll never forget the smells on market day, you know, walking through the streets of this small village and just Oh, just it was just amazing, all of the different smells, and it was such a community feel. And I thought, wow, why don't we do this in Canada? Like, why don't I have this experience? But that was probably just my family wasn't into it. I'm sure there were markets, but I think it's become a bigger thing in the last 20 years, thankfully, because it is so great. So, and then being in the Netherlands, you realize that you can travel all the way around Europe and visit all of these cultures, and each of them, food is so central to the culture. So, I remember going to Italy and sitting down for a meal with other exchange students, and they put spaghetti on the table, and we ate all the spaghetti as though that was the meal. And then the Italians were looking at us like, wow, these people don't know anything. That's the appetizer, Then they would bring out the pork chops, and then they would bring out the rest of the meal. And so we were all full of spaghetti, so we couldn't eat anymore. But it was just that, you just don't know. There's different cultures and traditions, and got to have like the great waffles in Belgium, and the great pastries in France, and each country. And that's what's so wonderful about Europe is that diversity of foods, and
It's
they're
very
all.
compact as well.
Yeah, and very iconic. Each place has their thing. So
Yeah, and also European culture has multiple European cultures have played a huge role in the people who've come from outside Canada to Canada. Your own family being an example of those of two culture, well, two and a half, three cultures. But many are embedded in our culture now, and they bring their food traditions to this part of the world. Early on, though, you started to have some sort of digestive issues. They were starting to be problematic. And that was also, in addition to seeing all these different kind of cultural patterns of with regard to food, you also were exploring of necessity some of the issues related to food for your own personal health and well-being. So how did these two things sort of coincide and interact?
yeah, I think for a lot of people, health is what drives them towards learning about food. So in my early 20s, I started to have irritable bowel syndrome. And anybody who's suffered from that knows that it's a very uncomfortable, painful, and embarrassing thing to have to deal with.
For sure.
And it really started to affect my movement. If I was going for a picnic or for a hike or, to do anything, I needed to know, where's the closest washroom, and who's going to be there, and what's the situation. And it started to really limit me, and I wanted to take charge of it. So I went to the doctor, and at the time, and I don't know if this is still the case, but the doctor really didn't help. He sort of
Sadly.
said, well, it's a thing, we can't really do anything about it. You just kind of have it. And
Sadly enough, it still is the case. And nutritional teaching for medical students is extremely limited. Medical students are taught biochemistry, they're taught physiology, but when it comes to actually the nitty-gritty of food, how you make it, what it does to your body, what micronutrients do to your body, all of that kind of stuff is not included in medical training. And I think it's the reason I'm pausing to say that is because I think it's not the way it should be. The fundamental determinants of health at a biological level are physical activity, the food we eat, and the stress experiences we have and how we handle them. And there really isn't a coherent approach to that in medical teaching. It's all about diseases and treatments, which is end of pipe. And but you were not there. You were finding that the source you thought might be useful wasn't useful, and that led you, as all the moves you had made probably did, to start exploring on your own.
Yeah, definitely. And I one thing I really noticed was that because I wasn't raised with any spices per se, other than salt and onions, that I wanted to like this food. And I remember living in Toronto for a period of time, and my now husband took me out for a falafel at a little, hole in the wall Lebanese falafel place. And I just remember, tasting tabbouleh and the lentils, and I'm just like, what, you know?
What did they do to this food? It tastes good.
I'm like, what is going on here? This is just a party in my mouth. And just going, wow, what else don't I know about food? You know, how many different things can I try? What have I been missing out on? And as it turned out, it was a lot. So, you know, it sparked something in like, I need to try all the things. So, you know, Jamaican roti. Yeah, that's okay. Whoa. You know, that's really on the edge of what my stomach can handle. I need to start on the very, very lowest level of the spice train.
Have some Jamaican spices. And I think they were called something like the devil's hellfire or something like that. Personal challenge to try and see if I could eat all the way up to the most heated of the spices, and I still have the scars to prove that I made it to the end.
it's dangerous.
And many foods are dramatic. They're not they're not quiet little retiring sort of morsels. They leap out at you and grab you by the throat and say, you're going to pay attention to me.
And I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah.
So when you embarked on this course of, you know, remedying the problems that the healthcare system wasn't particularly interested in, what kind of solutions did you come up with?
Well, you know, I looked at things, just general lifestyle things. You know, I polluted my body in the early 20s, as many did. You know, I ate a lot of fast food, and, you know, I didn't have parents who were really into cooking or any of that. So, I started to look at, well, what might trigger this? And so things like coffee and tomatoes and, you know, some of the more acidic foods seem to, although I happily eat and drink those now. But it was more, you know, even things like the time of day that you eat. So I wouldn't eat until 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And then your body can kind of go into spasm if you do that. So it's not just about what you're eating, it's when you're eating and how much you're eating, and really starting to realize that I'm going to get out of this body what I put into it. And it's, nobody's going to do that for me. That's my day-to-day decisions. And so that really, you know, pain is a great motivator.
Yes, it keeps me in business. I can tell you that. Without pain, what would I do?
And I wanted to focus on solutions, and I said, I can't live like this. And so, yeah.
So it was a gradual process. It took time to sort of work out a pattern for yourself.
Definitely. You know, and I think, again, back to being married to a Portuguese man, you know, we early on in the relationship went to Portugal, and I started to see, okay, well, now this is more, you know, rices and fish and all sorts of creatures of the sea and different spices. And I was very, very interested in that. And it gave me a curiosity about food.
Isn't it wonderful how that can happen? You can have a personal experience in your very body, and it responds to exploring and trying things and expanding your horizons. One major, we're on this sort of topic of how health influences our choices. You also went through kind of a transformation when you had your son. When your son was born, or even before he was born, in fact, you quoted to me an African saying, a baby is born when the idea forms in the mother's mind. So this also had a huge influence. You started to think about feeding this, as you described, this adorable little boy, the right kind of food. What was that like?
Yeah, well, you know, as any mother knows, you start to, as soon as you're pregnant or even before, they start to talk about, okay, well, what's this environment that this baby is going to be growing in? And then you start to get, well, you can't have, you know, soft cheese, and you can't have too much fish, and you don't want to have this and that. And so that was like, oh, okay, well, why would those foods not be safe? And what is it about those? And, you know, I worked in the film industry for a while in Vancouver and got really into documentary films. And so started down the road of, again, you know, tell me everything about all the things. And being pregnant and really starting to take care of my health and knowing that, you know, this isn't about just me anymore. This is about this other person. And then learning about processed food and things like BPA in bottles. And so I really wanted to avoid all of the toxins and chemicals. And so we blended his, you know, I boiled the carrots and blended them and boiled the, you know, did the apples with the spinach and tried to make sure that he was getting, you know, healthy foods and, you know, nursing versus formula, or, you know, everybody's got their reasons for doing each of the things, but, you know,
ultimately these, what you're describing though, is actually returning to the way food was always prepared and moving away, either deliberately or of necessity, to foods that were relatively speaking local, certainly fresh, and sort of unprocessed. The processing, the minimal processing that took place was in your hands rather than some unknown person who put it then, the processed food, into a container that you then opened and spooned out. It was you doing the whole process from the food to the to consumption of it. You mentioned getting the film industry. Just maybe mention that a little bit, and also your magnum opus that is not yet revealed to the public on the subject of hemp.
Oh, yes. Well, the film industry, for the most part, was I worked in television commercials and music videos. But then when I got pregnant, I was watching a lot of documentaries and planned to make a film. And so in the years leading up to being pregnant, I got interested in hemp through, I had made, used to be making bracelets and necklaces out of hemp because I was on set a lot and had some time to kill and I needed something to do with my hands. And so I would twine these necklaces and bracelets. And
but now you were starting to look at what hemp really was and its role in the world.
Yeah, what is this material? What is this? Where did this come from? And then I looked, oh, well, it's hemp. And what is this? And at the time, you know, in the late 90s, hemp, industrial hemp, had just become legal. And that caught my interest. Like, it's a plant. Why was it illegal? What's going on here? And so I went down that road of investigation again and ultimately traveled across the country to interview the pioneers in the Canadian hemp industry and thinking this is going to be a really interesting film. People are going to want to know this. You know, getting pregnant sort of derailed that. So the footage never saw the light of day. But
do you still have the footage, Kelly?
I do. Maybe
one day, you never know. An inevitable outcome, Kelly, of looking at hemp is that you start to look at what is a suitable crop for us to be growing. And of course, hemp is very durable compared to cotton, for example. You need far less water. You can grow it on much more marginal soil. It doesn't need a lot of pesticides because that aromatic material that's found in hemp plants actually is a defense compound, and it keeps a lot of insects away. It's a very hardy plant. But you also, around that time, saw a film that really changed things for you that was all about self-sufficiency, and that's a film about Mike Reynolds, the person who founded the Earthships movement. Mm-hmm. And it fascinated you. And you went to Seattle to see him, and it connected you to permaculture, which is a sort of a environmental self-sufficiency movement. Talk about that process, because it was formative for you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, films are so powerful, and they can be. And this one, you know, the interesting part for me was I was interested in it from a waste reduction strategy. This architect would take, you know, quote unquote, waste material like tires and cans and bottles and build houses out of them. And not just that, but he would integrate food growth within the house, and he would, you know, use passive solar gain and alternative energies. And so he built this little neighborhood basically in the middle of the desert in Taos, New Mexico, that was not attached to the grid and, you know, just in the middle of the desert. It, to me, it was just like, wow, how can they live there? And it's such a harsh environment. And that weekend in Seattle, there was a woman who spoke about permaculture and its relation to Earthships. You know, if you're going to have one of these houses, you're going to have to know how to grow food. And exactly, that really sparked something into me, because I realized, you know, I don't know a lot about growing food. And so permaculture really looked at closed loop systems, and that seemed brilliant to me. And one of Mike Reynolds's big frustrations in the architecture world was that we push nature away in our buildings. We try to get the water away. We try to, you know, keep the pests away. And, you know, it was so counterintuitive to him that he ripped up his diploma and said, I'm not doing this. I'm going to do things a different way, and spent years and years working actually on changing policy so that he would be allowed to build these radically sustainable homes.
Yeah, because we have in fact developed many, many aspects of our society that are linear rather than circular. Ironically, indigenous peoples have been telling us, think circular. And we've relentlessly said, no, we're going to go in a straight line from A to B, and everything will be perfect. And again, getting back to the situation we're dealing with today in our world with disruption from extreme weather events and an awareness that a lot of that's to do with producing a lot too many greenhouse gases, we're starting to realize that we have to have a circular economy. The kind of principles that underlie a small so-called earth ship are now being applied to what Buckminster Fuller called spaceship Earth. In other words, we are floating around in this one orb, and we have to look after it. We're going to be in deep trouble. And things went on from there. You went and studied. As you said, you're a late student, but when you got going, you weren't really a late student. You were just a late student in formal terms, I would guess, because in 2012, you got a certificate from UBC in a very creative program called Liberal Art Studies that allowed you to really put your intellectual exploratory skills to work on a constant basis. You had no formal kind of containment of your study area. You could sort of go where your heart and your mind took you. That must have been
The Liberal Studies program was, you know, it spoke to me because of the broadness of it. So it was psychology, philosophy, literature, theology, mythology, critical thinking, you know, globalization. It was just very, very broad. And so it gave me the opportunity again to seek to understand the world, which is always what I'm doing. I'm seeking to understand and make sense of things. And so that program, you know, it was great because it was also a continuing studies program. So being a young mother when I started, it was evenings and weekends, and, you know, thankfully I had a husband who was very, very supportive.
And the two of you also had a system where you paired off parenting.
Each of you would do a couple of years
and then switch around.
Yeah, exactly. We knew that we wanted to raise our son ourselves. And so we lived very frugally and humbly, and we still do to this day. You know, I think we've never been about stuff and material things. It's very much about experiences, connections with people, you know, living a good, simple, but fulfilling life. So yeah, I finished that program in 2012 and then, you know, moved out to the interior in 2013, because one of the things that came out of that was in the city, I didn't feel food secure. You know, mm-hmm. when those emergency situations happened, I didn't have a pantry. There was nowhere to store 72 hours extra food, you know, or water or anything like that. So it felt quite vulnerable living in the city, and knowing that, you know, you don't necessarily know your neighbors, and they're not necessarily looking out for you in an emergency. So that felt like, you know what, we need to be somewhere that we can build community. And ultimately, you know, I would say that I moved out to the interior for food security. I wanted a place where I could put my hands in the dirt and plant some food.
Well, you have moved on and got into that in a very formal way, because a little while after, in 2014, you got a permaculture design certificate. You embedded yourself formally into the systems whereby we produce food but also restore ecosystems. In other words, the two were together. And you mentioned to me a couple of times that social justice has always been sort of a theme in your mind, this sort of idea that we should be fair about how we do things, how we treat each other and that kind of thing. I sense that this is sort of where this is going, in a concrete way. You know, permaculture gives every plant in the ecosystem a position and every animal. And having food security means that everybody has a right to food. It's not just some people or, you know, as in Animal Farm, George Orwell said, some people are more equal than others. We're all equal. That seems to be a theme. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, you know, food is the great equalizer. And it's the thing that we go to always. I mean, when someone has passed away, you know, you take them food, you bring, you know, the food train starts.
Yes. The prodigal son comes home and or daughter, and you feed them food as the first act.
Exactly. So that is really what brings us together. And it, to me, it's the thing that bridges cultures. It bridges religion. It bridges, you know, sexuality or anything, you know, it's above all of it. At the end of the day, we all need food on the table. And so the equity of that, you know, has been something that you know, yeah, I feel that everybody deserves to be nourished.
Listeners should not be surprised to learn that a few years ago you ran for the Green Party. Running for the Green Party in this particular riding is not an act of aspiring to political office. More, it's an act to bring certain ideas forward. And you, to your credit, stood up and said, okay, I'm going to be a visible marker for certain kinds of values, obviously centered around proper relationship with the ecosystem around us. But I want to talk, as we're coming close to the end of the show, about somebody and a tradition that you have become engaged with in recent years, and that is Indigenous perspectives on things. And one of the persons you told me earlier was a mentor for you, yet another mentor. We all have a series of them, and they play important roles in our lives. And that's Marielle Bélanger. Silk's performant artist and historian, and very much involved in the kinds of ideas and perspectives that you yourself have grown into over the years. Why don't you talk a little bit about Marielle and about this kind of interaction with Indigenous ways of looking at things?
Mm-hmm. She is an incredible knowledge keeper, and you know, we actually met on Twitter, funny enough. Before moving out here, I had started following her, and what fascinated me about her was her own exploration into ancestry, family history, and the land. You know, it all comes back to the land with Indigenous people. And I was doing my own family explorations. And so when I moved here, we connected in real life, and that's blossomed into this wonderful friendship, because, you know, we have such deep conversations about history. And I think what's important in these conversations is to be open and to allow yourself to hear about all the bad things that happened, and not necessarily feel personally responsible, but know that you know, we as settlers had a part to play, and there was a benefit for us coming here, and that was at the expense of someone else. And you know, that's a very humbling place to get to, but I think if we can get to that place, that's where the healing starts. And within the truth and reconciliation process, you know, it's the truth part. That's the part that we're really learning about. And, you know, I took the time to read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, which is, you know, quite a large document.
It is indeed.
And on page 2, I found one of my ancestors' names.
Really?
And that...
An Icelandic ancestor?
No, actually, on the Irish side, he was an Indian agent. Mm. And that really kind of shook me. I went, wow, okay. So it's a distant relative, but wow, okay. I guess there is something here. And I think there's a want to, I do want to be part of the reconciliation process, and I think that's very, very important.
I think it's clear that building a food forest, allowing a food forest to develop in this community in Salmon Arm with the cooperation and using space available through the Salvation Army is in a certain way a culmination of all these trends in your life coming together and leading to using food from what you gather in the environment. It could have been, you know, picking food out of the garden, but in this case, it's food out of the forest, which is a deep tradition in indigenous culture in both North and South America. In the book by Charles C. Mann, 1493, he talks about the fact that food forests in southeastern states were not only a source of food, but a better source of food than almost any that we've derived since then with our more grain-focused agriculture. And mast, M-A-S-T, was the food made out of nuts gathered from food forest that sustained southeastern cultures in the indigenous world. So, I mean, it is like so many threads coming together for you to be involved in this process. And we're going to be delighted to talk about that next week. And we'll have, along with you, we'll have the coordinator of the Salvation Army here, part of our show, and we'll talk about that project, which is a wonderful project. I want to thank you, Kelly, again for being part of the show, and I look forward to talking to you next week. And you have been a very delightful person to explore the world of food with. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and stay safe, everyone. It's been a brutal week, so sending out love.
Absolutely. Thank you. Mm-hmm.